KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Darby Maloney, sitting in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is business. Really, all right, life, peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Lee Daniels' The Butler is a historical drama about African Americans that's doing remarkably well at the box office, and it almost didn't make it to the multiplex. Lee Daniels talks about how it took a slew of producers to pull it off. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times and Mike Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Hello, Mike.
Hello, John.
Kim and I have talked a lot, and in fact, we talked last week about the lessons the big studios could learn from some of these summer fiascos. That's a tally that includes The Lone Ranger, White House Down, After Earth, maybe an animated film or four. But I think we should focus today a little bit on what they might learn from some of the more successful independent films. It's been an amazing year for some smaller movies. We've seen The Butler do incredibly well, Woody Allen do incredibly well, and I think the audience is really voting with their wallets.
Yeah, I think turns out grown-ups still want to actually go to the movie theater, and they don't just want to see bang-em-up, slash-em-up kind of movies.
Well, Woody Allen's movie is going into its widest release this weekend of any film in Woody Allen's history. Now, it's not going to touch inflation-adjusted dollars, the kind of income he made on Annie Hall. But still, the grosses on some of these movies are really remarkable. We talked about Lee Daniels' The Butler. This is a movie that Sony dumped. It took a miracle to get its $30 million budget financed. It's probably going to gross, when all is said and done at the end of the summer, $100 million. Fruitvale Station, probably $15 million more to go. The Way, Way Back is going to cross $20 million. And even The Purge, released by Universal, but a $3 million independently financed film, is up to $65 million. Amazing stories at the end of the summer.
And you mentioned Blue Jasmine, Woody Allen's new movie. It's also garnering some of the best reviews he's received in quite a while. So it's great to see these alternative movies now at the box office. And who knows, maybe the majors will actually learn something from this.
Doubt it. Speaking of outsized returns, you have a very interesting study in TV Guide magazine this week about some of the top salaries in television.
Yeah, we do this every year. We survey, we talk to agents, managers, producers, everyone around town, just to sort of see what everyone is making these days. And the big story this year actually comes out of late night. I think, you know, everyone sort of assumed that Jay Leno and David Letterman would forever be the highest paid stars in late night. But we have a new champ. We have a new king of late night salaries, actually, Jon Stewart, who, funny enough, is just coming off a long break shooting his own movie and heading back to the anchor chair after a summer hiatus, makes almost $30 million a year. Now, his show actually does very well with adults 18 to 49, with the demographics. So you can sort of see why this now makes sense. CBS made a strong play for him a few years ago when it looked like Letterman might be retiring. So that helped his salary go up. But fascinating, for the first time ever, a cable star beating all the broadcast network stars in late night.
And what you report is that his salary is about what Letterman and Kimmel make combined. So clearly he's doing something well for Comedy Central. And I thought there was a fascinating little tidbit about daytime syndication salaries and a certain judge who's making a lot more than any justice of the Supreme Court.
I know this blows everyone's minds away every year. Judge Judy making $47 million a year. So let's all just stand back for a second and ponder what we've done with our own lives and where we went wrong.
I think I'm happy not to follow in her footsteps. Another interesting story in television right now, we've talked in the past about the launch of Fox Sports and Al Jazeera. There seem to be some unusual plays for millennials. I think the very audience that historically is tuning out of television.
This is kind of fascinating. You know, the stereotype is that millennials don't watch TV anymore. They still do. It's a stereotype that's not quite accurate. It's just harder to find them, and they're not watching necessarily on the screen. They're watching on devices, what have you. But there are several new networks that want to cash in on this desirable demographic. There's a new network actually coming from Participant Media, which, John, you obviously know through all their feature activity. They're launching a channel called Pivot TV that just started a few weeks ago, focusing on the idea that millennials want to make a difference in the world, want to change the world. So they have a number of shows that sort of are devoted to that.
This is a channel from the people behind An Inconvenient Truth, but I'm much more struck by P. Diddy's cable offering. Yes. That doesn't seem to be, I'm not sure what that is or who that's for, but tell us a little bit more about his network.
Right. Now that he's a mogul, he's Sean Combs again. So he's going by Diddy Combs, I suppose. But it's called Revolt. It's one of the channels actually that is being launched by Comcast. You know, when Comcast purchased NBC, they agreed to the FCC that they would help finance several new channels that are minority-owned or run by minorities. This is one of them, geared towards millennials, with the idea that MTV sort of long ago gave up its charter as being the network about music. Revolt is going to be about the music culture, do a lot of music news, and focus on being live. All these networks are about social media these days, but they think that there's still space for young people who want a channel sort of devoted more towards music.
And FX, which doesn't think it's quite young enough, is going to try to get a little bit younger?
Right. The FX mother channel, still has sort of more adult dramas like Sons of Anarchy, but FXX, which is the spinoff channel, it's taken over the spot formerly held by the Fox Soccer Channel, will focus more on 18 to 34-year-olds, the millennials, with sort of their edgier, more comedic shows like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is moving to the new channel. And the idea is FX has been aggressively acquiring the broadcast rights to a lot of theatrical movies, and they're also developing a lot more young-skewing shows, and now this will be the opportunity to sort of spread the wealth and amortize the cost of some of those purchases by launching another channel.
And I guess if FXX works, then we'll have FXXX next season.
Exactly. Hardcore porn coming soon to your cable dial.
I was thinking more of a teenage channel. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, John.
That was John Horn of the Los Angeles Times and Mike Schneider, LA Bureau Chief of TV Guide Magazine. This is The Business, and I'm Darby Maloney, sitting in for Kim Masters. Our guest is filmmaker Lee Daniels, whose new movie is Lee Daniels, The Butler. The movie stars Forrest Whitaker as Cecil Gaines, an African-American butler who served in 8 White House administrations, inspired by the true life of Eugene Allen, but fictionalized by screenwriter Danny Strong. The movie tracks the plight of African-Americans from segregation through the civil rights era. In this clip, Cecil's son has joined the Black Panthers and challenges his parents' view of race relations. Cecil's wife is played by Oprah Winfrey.
What was the name of that movie, honey?
In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier?
Sidney Poitier is a white man's fantasy of what he wants us to be.
What are you talking about? He just won the Academy Award. He's breaking down barriers for all of us.
By being white. By acting white. Sidney Poitier is nothing but a rich Uncle Tom.
Look at you. All puffed up. Put your hat on your head. Coming in here, saying whatever you want. You need to go.
What?
Get the hell out of my house!
What are you doing?
No, get on out!
Now everybody just sit
down. Sorry, Mr. Butler. I didn't mean to make fun of your hero.
Everything you are and everything you have is because of that butler.
Lee Daniels has been pretty open about the fact that the awkward title, Lee Daniels the Butler, wasn't his idea. Originally, the film was simply titled The Butler, but Warner Brothers claimed the rights to the title because of a 1916 short film of the same name. So, Lee Daniels the Butler was a compromise devised by the Weinstein Company, the film's distributor. But coming to terms with that self-important title wasn't as hard as coming up with the money to make the movie in the first place. Daniels, who directed the 2009 film Precious, which won 2 Oscars, teamed up with the late great producer Laura Ziskin, known for helming the Spider-Man franchise. Prior to her death in 2011, she had made The Butler a top priority. When Sony Pictures let the movie go, Daniels and Ziskin connected with African-American entrepreneur Sheila Johnson, who co-founded the BET Network. They began the hunt for the $30 million they needed to cover the production budget.
I understand that financing this movie was a true feat.
Yeah.
And I think you said it's because it's an African-American movie. Is that why?
Yeah. I don't know how many producers are on this movie, but I stopped counting at 20. Because every time they gave us some money, we had to, you know, throw another producer credit out. And I didn't understand off of the heels of Precious, which made a lot of money. I think worldwide, $100 million, like a lot of money. It was incomprehensible to me that something that was more commercial and certainly more accessible to mid-America.
A PG-13.
And PG-13 wouldn't. But I think that it's not just about black films. It's also about dramas, you know, and the studios really don't see dramas as making money. And I think the black drama even added some more. And then they were going to do it for a specific budget. You know, they have like 10 million or however. And yet, I do believe that, if it were, well, I don't know. That's presumptuous of me to say. But I think
you were almost going to say if it were a white drama, it would be easier.
I don't know. I don't know. I wonder.
Yeah.
I don't. I can't help but wonder whether that could be the case.
So was Sheila Johnson the first one in trying to make this film? She was BET.
Incredible woman. We came in simultaneously because Laura
Ziskin,
who was just the love of my life, and that's the reason why I did the film. She understood me. I felt safe. You know, I'd never done a film in the system. At the time, it was at Sony. And I didn't care to do, to answer to suits. You know, I'd done, my first film was Monsters Ball as a producer. And then on to Woodsman. And, you know, they'd all been films that had been independently raised. We raised money independently. But I felt safe with Laura. And she had cancer. I had not worked with anybody that had cancer before. Didn't know anybody really. I thought she was going to live forever. And she, what was great about her was that she knew what she didn't know. She said, Lee, I'm a studio girl. Like I went from studio to studio and I don't know about raising money. So I want you to help me, teach me. I said, well, come on. And then we hit the streets and, her partner, Pam Williams, was her sidekick at the time. And for 4 years, we hit the streets developing the script with Danny Strong and raised money. And 3 days before she died, she had found this black lady that hit the lotto. And she said, she calls me up, Lee, I got a live one. And I go, what? And she said, the lady's hit the number. I said, get her to Santa Monica. So we had a Skype. And I could see that in the Skype that she wasn't doing well, that something wasn't right.
With Laura, you mean?
Yeah, something wasn't right. And then she went upstairs, and the next day she went into a coma.
Hmm.
And I love her. And I love her with all of my heart. I love her because she's the reason she's up there looking over me now. And she left Spider-Man to do this movie. She said, this is an important movie, Lee. You have to do this movie.
So the live one was...
She never invested in the movie anyway.
She literally found a black lady who won the lotto?
Yes, and she's so genius. Weird. It was genius.
So Sheila.
Sheila. I met Sheila through her.
Through Laura, because they did something with the cancer fundraising.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we took a train together to D.C., and we sat with Sheila, who really was the matriarch, who then came in and just opened her purse. And then she helped. Not only she gave money, but she went and got money for us. She began with other African Americans getting money for us because she felt that the story should be told.
So you then, you still are making a PG-13 movie, even though you've said, I think, that this is not something you... I mean, clearly anyone who's seen your movies know you're not necessarily a PG-13 kind of guy.
That guy.
So the decision was what? How did that work?
It was easy because the script was what it was.
But you worked closely with Danny on the script.
Very closely.
So you could have been like,
I believe I could have talked him into getting an R rating. It wasn't It wasn't that it was that it was edicted to me. I could have fought for an R version with my investors, but I didn't because I needed my kids to see it. You know, it was important that children see the film. So at its core, it was all about getting that rating so that children could see the film. It wasn't, you know, I mean, I think, and I have done, all of my work has been, I've been fighting with the MPAA for an R rating. Most of my stuff is non-rated that I have to fight for an R.
To get away from an NC-17 or
mm-hmm. And it was a stretch for me as a filmmaker, too, because I had never done anything like this. It was really something that I wanted to prove to myself that I could do. And my mom's church groups could go see, you know, she was involved with a few churches, and it was important. You know, she's not going to be around forever, and she always says, why can't you make movies like Tyler Perry? You know, Miss Johnson at the church says something's wrong with you. You make movies about pedophiles and all this. Why can't you just make a movie like, you know, Tyler Perry? I said, okay, Mama, I'll try to do it.
Put on a nice dress with some padding.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Darby Maloney, sitting in for Kim Masters, who recently spoke with Lee Daniels. His new movie, Lee Daniels the Butler, has a massive, towering inferno-style cast, with Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey at the center. The film also stars Cuba Gooding Jr., Terrence Howard, Mariah Carey, John Cusack, Vanessa Redgrave, Jane Fonda, and many, many more.
I mean, it's remarkable to see Robin Williams as Dwight Eisenhower. Did you call him up and say, I have this notion that's very, not necessarily the way you're normal, you know, nothing to do with that fast. I mean, he's done dramatic roles before. Mm. That's not the question, really. Yeah. It's the question of how did that go down?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's our favorite.
Okay. Well, what happened was that, not that I don't love Robin, I love Robin, and I think that all the actors that we've hired are spectacular, but the African-American actors could not greenlight the film. We needed names, otherwise we weren't going to greenlight the film, and I certainly wasn't going to Oprah, because I wouldn't be able to direct her. And so I never, the notion of going to her, though I could have probably gotten the money from her, I didn't want to, because I wanted her to work for me. And so, you know, what was important was that we did everything we could to get the movie greenlit. And then I had a choice. The choice was, okay, is it going to be harder for me to, these identifiable faces going to take us out of the movie? And do I get unknowns? But I felt that, you know, once I was resolved in my head creatively that it was okay, I felt that I would do anything to get people to see this film. And I thought that if these names are to help us, then I'm going to try to unknow them. You know, if I could just make them disappear, which I love doing. I love changing people's perceptions of who they think they know. And we try to do that with Oprah, but in a big way, but, you know, with each of the presidents.
Very much, I mean, that's a face that is imprinted on people's, like somewhere in the neural substrate. There's a little Oprah image, I think, of all Americans at this point.
Oprah! Around the world.
So did Robin Williams thought, cool, I'll play Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah. I think that they loved the script. Danny Strong wrote an incredible script. So I think that I'm just a puppeteer. You know, Danny wrote a kick-ass script, and I think that people jumped aboard this story. They all of them, from Vanessa to Jane, have strong political beliefs.
Vanessa Redgrave,
yeah. They all have strong political beliefs, and I think that that's
they felt they were part of something in doing the film, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I hope you won't take it as a negative. It was a fun thing in watching the movie, like who's going to be Kennedy? You know, I didn't really read up the list beforehand and to see who pops up. It was
you're not insulting. I like when people tell me that they don't like something. I learn from it. You know what I mean? I am a masochist at heart, so I'm always trying to make things better. And so I don't know, maybe it's something to do with my dad, but I like to be told it's not good enough, because it's never good enough.
Coming up after a short break, Lee Daniels talks about how he broke into the film business and how being a gay African-American filmmaker impacts his storytelling. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Mm-hmm. Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Darby Maloney, sitting in for Kim Masters. Our guest is filmmaker Lee Daniels, whose new movie is Lee Daniels, The Butler. It's a historical drama about an African-American butler who served in the White House during 8 administrations and lived to see Barack Obama elected. It's currently in theaters and is on track to bring in about $100 million. Now, the movie deviates a bit from Lee Daniels' prior films, which often had grim storylines, overt sexual content, and featured troubled characters. Precious, for instance, which was nominated for 6 Oscars and won 2, told the story of an overweight black girl who's raped by her father and abused by her mother. Daniels also produced the 2001 movie Monsters Ball. That film had explicit sexual content and dealt with suicide and loss. Halle Berry won an Oscar for her role in that movie. Now, these films were no doubt influenced by Daniels' own suffering, which he elaborated on when he recently spoke with Kim Masters.
I first knew that I wanted to be a screenwriter, filmmaker, something, when I read Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on the steps as a 9-year-old.
As a 9-year-old.
to my neighbors, and I played out all the characters.
Oh my God,
from George to Martha to, I wish too. I mean, can you imagine?
No.
And so that led to a burning desire to direct. I didn't understand what it was. I couldn't articulate what it was that I wanted to do. And so, you know, and this is part of the reason why I did the movie was because, was to understand my dad's anger. He beat me quite a bit, and he was angry, and I didn't understand why he beat me. And now I know why, and I've forgiven him. I was put in a trash can, and in the trash can, I would write things. I would draw things, and I would imagine that I was in far-off places after beatings. He didn't like the fact that I was gay, and he sort of saw something that was different.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go deep in myself, and I knew that I wanted to express myself in a different way. And so, anyway, that led to off-Broadway, Running Away. And trying to also get in the Studio 54 once every 13th time when I was 17, and directing one-act plays up in Harlem, but not really making any money at it, just trying to have, you know, trying to understanding what it was finally that I wanted to do. And then I moved to Los Angeles, and I worked as a receptionist at a nursing agency, and I ended up being the manager of the nursing agency. Let's just say that your mom got sick and she wanted a homemaker or a nurse's aide. And so I was 22 running this company, and I said, I can do this myself. And I ended up opening my own, and I ended up having 500 nurses. And it was just when something called HIV, no one knew what it was. And so I had these black women. No one wanted to take care of these men that were diagnosed with AIDS because they didn't know what it was at the time.
Scary.
In the early
mm-hmm.
80s and mid 80s. And before I knew it, I was the first nursing agency that was taking care of people for AIDS Project LA. We were under contract with the American Heart and Lung Association, and on and on and on. And I made an enormous amount of money not knowing nothing about the nursing business.
I had no idea.
All.
You had this whole life as an entrepreneur.
And then I would go and I would direct one-act plays in Baldwin Hills. And then I said, I can't do this anymore. You know, I had a lot of money. And what do you do when you have a lot of money and you have no education? You do a lot of drugs. You do a lot of stupid things. You buy cars. You buy diamonds. You buy just stupid stuff. And so then I left. I sold my agency and went to work as a casting assistant for Prince. It was my first official job.
Mm-hmm. And you worked on Purple Rain.
Uh-huh. And Under the Cherry Moon, which led me then to casting music videos. And then Warner's was happy with me because at the time they said, oh, we're happy with your work. We're going to make you head of minority talent. So it was pre-Spike Lee.
Yeah.
And it was post the black exploitation era. So there's really nothing to cast that was minority. Right. So I had a pencil in my hand and, like, you know, I would go see all these plays and I discovered Dreamgirls on Broadway and represented actors like Loretta Devine and Marianne Jean-Baptiste from Secrets and Lies, which were responsible for her Oscar. And it was a long stretch of that. And then I got tired of telling the actors no, that there is no work. And I decided that I had to make my own work for them. And so hence Monsters Ball as a producer and still sort of directing off and on.
So you sort of educated yourself through Monsters Ball and
I learned. No, I educated myself prior to that. I also represented Nastassja Kinski, Wes Bentley. I don't know whether you remember him from American Beauty. Mm-hmm. I got him a SAG card. Michael Shannon was my first client. Well, he was one of my first clients. I was his manager. I got him a SAG card. I saw him on off Broadway. And so a lot of my work was really as a manager, I was studying directors with the actors that I was that I put on set.
You've talked very specifically about, mm-hmm. you know, this is my identity. My films are black gay films.
Yeah. Well, and not yeah.
No?
Well, they're not black gay films. I am a gay man who happens to be black, who happens to be a filmmaker. And you know, I ran from that for such a long time, my identity, because I was beaten for it, you know. And then my dad died. And I was sort of happy that he did because I don't know that I would have been alive. He just kept beating me for being gay. Mm. And then, so my mom didn't want me around because what in the African American community, we don't embrace that.
Right.
You know, we simply don't because men have to be strong.
Right.
And being gay is not a good thing. And so my mom took me to an all white school when I was 8 in the main line. And, in Radnor High School, where at that point, I mean, at 12, at that point, I went from being gay, gay, gay to nigger, nigger, nigger.
Oh, nice.
So I don't know which one.
Which one is, yeah.
Faggot, faggot, or nigger, nigger. And I think it's made me the man that I am. I think that for a long time, I lied about it, you know, and it just wasn't good, you know. You know, it was part of the drugs and hatred, self-hatred, you know. It's destructive.
I can't articulate what
it's like to wake up and walk down the street and you can't get a taxi with your kids. You will never understand it. You will never understand it. And so it's almost politically incorrect to talk about it because we feel like we've heard it. We got a black president. So, you know, and let's just sweep it under the carpet and let's not talk about it. And let's not talk about bullying. You know, let's not talk about it. But it's a very, very, very painful experience to live. And, I try to show that in all of my work, you know, the personal atrocities that I've lived, you know, for so long. I'd learned to hold my bladder because I was too afraid to go to the bathroom.
Who's waiting?
Yeah.
In Hollywood today, we're doing that whole black gay.
Yeah.
Which one is more accepted? Which one is less accepted?
I don't know.
Or do you have a feeling about
that? I mean,
that?
I have to, I don't know what to say that to that. I want to answer that question to you, but I have to be very honest with you that I'm afraid to answer that question because, and I have to stay like Cecil and that silent because I want to work.
The butler. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was filmmaker Lee Daniels talking with Kim Masters. His new film, Lee Daniels, The Butler, starring Forrest Whitaker as Cecil Gaines, is in theaters now. And that's The Business. I'm Darby Maloney, and I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Darby Maloney, sitting in for Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.